The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. The magic of the FA Cup replays. A little dink from Mata gets Manchester United past Wolves, while Lo Celso and Lamela give Spurs a much-needed win. Is there any point in replays? Just ask Joel Linton, who scores a goal against Rochdale. We'll also ask Sid Lowe if Quique Setién will be any good for Barcelona after Ernesto Valverde gets the boot for taking his team to the top of La Liga. We'll talk AFCON in 2021, the 52-year-old who signed another professional contract, and the 20-year-old who swapped the Conference South for Love Island. And as always, we'll look ahead to the Premier League this weekend, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
It's nice to see you.
It's always a pleasure to see you, Max.
You look lovely.
Thank you.
John Brodkin.
Hello.
Deputy Football Editor.
Sounds glamorous, eh?
It does, yeah. Podcast debut.
Yeah.
How long have you been at The Guardian, John?
A long time, just over 20 years.
20 years. And have you been pushing for this appearance for 20 years?
Well, 19 of them, yes.
Right,
and finally, obviously, the barrel has been scraped to the point where here I am. What a moment.
That's amazing, because the podcast didn't even start until 2006.
I saw it coming. I said, you've got to have a podcast. And finally, they came around to it and wouldn't have me on.
Like Robbie Keane, supported the pods since you were a boy. Does that mean you're Barry's boss?
Well, that sounds a very strange way of putting it, but partly, I suppose.
Are you happy with his work?
Fantastic. Absolutely brilliant.
Do you really mean that?
I do.
Okay,
Barry's
great.
Wonderful. We love Barry.
I'm very low maintenance. I don't throw diva strops. I don't...
Have any ambition.
Have any ambition whatsoever. Wilson doesn't see me as a threat. I didn't even get an FA Cup third round game this season. That's how far my stock has fallen.
Jonathan Wilson, it's nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
How's life?
I mean, the same as usual.
Okay, that sounds good. Manchester United 1, Wolves 0 then. Sam says, what's more tedious for Barry, Manchester United v Wolves or Ireland v Denmark?
I didn't mind this Manchester United-Wolves game. I thought it was okay. It was certainly better than the first one, but it was a low bar. But yeah, it was all right. I've seen a lot worse games of football.
And what a lovely finish from Juan Mata, John. He's a lovely man. Everybody likes him. And it was quite nice to see him race clear from a defence and see if he could manage to do anything before everyone caught up with him.
Yes, his painfully slow moment was, I think, captured in the first half when Traore skipped past him as if he simply wasn't there. But he took the goal extremely well, and in the few moments where Manchester United looked as if they may have a bit of invention, he was at least often in the midst of that, including very early on when I think it was his pass that put James through for an early chance. So, but yes, he's a nice man and a nice goal, and on they roll, pretty unimpressively, I thought. I found it more tedious than Barry did, I must be honest.
Where did you stand?
I was at a quiz.
Oh, so, what type of quiz?
It was a quiz at the Oval.
Mm-hmm.
Came second, a bit annoying.
Who did you lose to?
A team of people I played cricket with. It was a bit disappointing.
Okay.
We only got 3.5 questions wrong out of 40. But, you know, standards are very high these days.
Okay.
It's a question. I mean, say what you think.
Okay.
The question was, in the Harry Potter series,
mm-hmm.
what special talent does an animagus have? And we said shape-shifting, and we only got half a point for it. They wanted specifically the ability to change into an animal, which, given some of the other marking, I thought was a bit harsh. And that would have taken us to a tiebreak. But so anyway, I was following it between rounds on my phone. Obviously, wouldn't have my phone out during the quiz. I've got standards.
Mm-hmm.
And the mild excitement was thinking that Neto had scored, and then after round two, I found out he hadn't.
Well, it was one of those VARs, wasn't it? Ben says nobody wants to talk about it, but we have to. VAR is a clear and obvious error, end of, but it is insidiously wearing us down like a Mourinho virus. Our fatigue with it is just another way it is killing the host. Please use your platform to save the game. Please, Barry, you have a platform.
And with that apparently comes great responsibility, single-handedly saving football. I mean, it's not really VAR that's the problem in this situation, is it? It's the handball law, which... I thought, say, the Declan Rice one last Friday night, he got a clear advantage from his admittedly accidental handball that he could do very little about. I don't think Wolves benefited from the same advantage last night. Who's it, Raul Jimenez that handled? But that's the law, and the law is an ass, so it needs to be changed.
Producer Jonathan writes, what, he passed it with his hand! Exclamation mark, exclamation mark.
That's not the way I saw it.
How did you see it, John?
It was the correct decision given the way the laws of the game are now. No question about that. So from that point of view, it did its job. I think, for example, with the Aubameyang tackle that led to the red card, that was an example of VAR being well used. But generally, I'm not a fan. I wouldn't have brought it in and I would personally get rid of it.
All right. Brandon Williams looks like quite a good prospect, doesn't he? Gareth says, will Luke Shaw ever play for United again? Gary Neville saying, I like Brandon Williams. What I like about him specifically is he has that look in his eye of someone that would eat his opponent's nose to win the match.
What I've seen of him, he looks really, really good. And he's one of the sort of exciting young crop of players United have who possibly do give them hope for the future. But as with all of them, the worry you have is, do they have too many of these kids? And what, you know, where's the leadership coming from if you just have kids? Do they actually develop? But yeah, at the minute, there's no question he's playing better than Luke Shaw. I mean, Luke Shaw's career is a very sad thing. You know, that injury seems to have ruined everything for him.
But it's not too late for him, is it? I mean,
it's a long time since he had got the injury. When was it? It was 4 or 5 years ago. It was under Van Gaal, wasn't it? So 4 or 5 years.
But didn't he get good again under Mourinho? Wasn't he the one?
I think he got adequate.
He got, you know, Mourinho was nasty to him, and then Luke Shaw sort of proved.
I mean, I don't think it was consistent, not, okay, high level.
I wonder whether perhaps the constant, and I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say, bullying to which he was subjected publicly under Jose Mourinho perhaps has had a detrimental effect on his progress than as the broken leg. I'm only hypothesizing here, but it can't have been very helpful, you know, to be constantly publicly pilloried by your manager. And I thought he should have left Manchester United when he had the chance.
But yeah, I suppose the counter is you just don't know what's happening.
Well, that is true, and some people are going to say that this is just part of, I don't like Jose Mourinho, and I'm not a fan, that's quite abundantly clear, but I thought the manner in which he treated Luke Shaw was particularly nasty, even by his standards. But again, I'm just guessing.
Ollie brought on Marcus Rashford, who then got injured, so he looks unlikely for the Liverpool game, which is pretty unlucky. Our friend Miguel Delaney wrote an article about Maurizio Pochettino and saying, you know, Manchester United are going to miss out on Pochettino because of this loyalty to Solskjaer. John, do you think he's right about that? What would you do if you were Ed Woodward, amongst other things?
I would stick with Solskjaer for the time being, I have to say. I think there's too much a culture of getting rid of managers extremely quickly. I don't think Manchester United have been great, of course I don't, but I do think he deserves a bit longer to try to prove his worth. They've had an up and down season, and perhaps there'll be more ups in the future. And I think he merits a bit more time to achieve that. I was very unimpressed with them last night. I thought they played poorly. I thought they lack invention. I think they lack players high up the field without Rashford, who can drive forward dangerously with the ball and create problems and for opponents. What I will say in their defence is I was just scooting through some of the stats after the game, and I found it interesting that Wolves have played 26 matches since they failed to score against Braga. And in those 26 games, they failed to score only on 3 occasions. One of those was against Liverpool. 2 of them were against Manchester United. Now, that doesn't mean Manchester United play well. They didn't play well last night. But I wonder whether some credit should be given to them, notwithstanding the fact that City made them look rather foolish not so long ago. Perhaps there is something to be said if they are achieving a clean sheet against a team who almost always score.
I would direct you to the column you've asked me to write for Sunday, in which I'll give you the highlights now. Since he got the job permanently, Solskjaer has the worst win percentage of any Manchester United manager since Herbert Bamlett, who was sacked in 1931, having gotten relegated to Division 2. They're conceding 33% more goals per game under Solskjaer than they were under Mourinho. They're conceding 3 times as many goals to counter-attacks than they were under Mourinho, which I think is significant because it suggests the pressing isn't right. I think they look fine when there's space in behind the opponent, whether because the opponent attacks them as City did in that league game, or as Tottenham did in the league game, or as, say, Norwich or Newcastle have done, having gone behind against them. But when they have to break a team down, they don't seem to have any sort of cohesive plan of how to do that. They actually play fewer passes per game than they did under Mourinho. Everything is actually just slightly worse, or in some cases, very much worse than it was under Mourinho. And while I sort of agree with the general sentiment that the football is a very impatient world at the moment, just because some managers have been sacked prematurely doesn't mean that sacking every manager early is the wrong decision. And 44 games into his, league games into his reign, I think probably we should have seen more. For all that there are many, many other problems at the club, and for all that the injuries have been a big issue.
I mean, I thought Wolves were the better team last night, even in defeat. And they had a almost score. They hit the post, and it was a Ruben Neves pass, which actually reminded me of the Kevin De Bruyne type passes we were talking about on Monday that only Kevin De Bruyne could do. Well, it turns out Ruben Neves, he might have been practicing since, but that was just a wonderful pass. And there's just no one in the Manchester United team really that can do that, apart from Pogba, who clearly doesn't want to be there and is not in the team at the moment. But they need transfers. But are you going to trust Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to be the man to give them this load of money they need to spend? I don't think it would be a great idea if you could get Mauricio Pochettino as an alternative.
Well, I think that's the point. When there is such an obvious candidate there, and of all people, anybody I can think of in the last sort of 10, 20 years, who you think that is clearly a good manager. He left his previous club for understandable reasons. The reasons why it sort of went slightly sour at Tottenham, it completely graspable from the outside. There is this outstanding candidate who's just waiting. Don't miss out on him. And I think the thing that really troubles me about Solskjaer is I think modern football at the highest level is about how well you construct transitions and construct attacks. And Klopp is brilliant at that. Guardiola's brilliant at that. Mourinho, I don't think, is brilliant at that. And I think that's where football's moved on from Mourinho's time. Pochettino is brilliant at that. Mm. There's no evidence whatsoever Solskjaer can do that.
And actually, it's a point that Tim Stillman has made on this pod. There are more big clubs than there are big managers at the moment. So if there is one, you should probably go and get him. From the MBM by Scott Murray, a sour note for Venegra, who appears to have pulled a hamstring in the final stages. Very good.
Just one final thing about the Man U Wolves before we move on. The tickets for Wolves supporters at Old Trafford last night were £55, which is quite an astonishing amount of money for an away fan, for an FA Cup replay, particularly after the dross they were subjected to in the first game. And that was, I think, £20 more expensive than Man U fans had to pay to go to Molineux. And, people complain about crowds being down at FA Cup matches and it losing its magic, but that's extortion.
Because there's the 20s plenty... don't away fans at Premier League games, there's a cap on...
Cap at 30,
I think. So it's strange that isn't the same cap in the FA Cup.
Well, have to pay £55 to travel from Wolverhampton to Manchester on a school night, as well as the other expenses you're going to incur, it just beggars belief. Mm. It's really graspy.
United have cancelled their winter break trip, which they were likely to spend in Qatar due to safety concerns with the rising tensions in the region. To the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, Spurs 2, Middlesbrough 1. Early goals from Lo Celso and Lamella. They both played well. The first goal, Wilson, came from Borough trying to play out from the back. One of the goals that Rochdale conceded against Newcastle was very similar. Do we applaud teams of all levels for trying to do this, or should they not just get rid?
I mean, if you play like that, that kind of thing will happen every now and again. So, you have to accept it. Rochdale have had loads of credit, quite rightly, this season for the football they've played in League One. You can't simultaneously praise them for that and then condemn them when the keeper underhits a pass to the fullback. You are going to concede two or three goals a season from losing the ball in your own third. The good calculation you have to make as a manager is, do we gain more than those three or four goals by doing that? And I think the evidence of Rochdale this season is pretty clear that they do. And, Middlesbrough have been playing, the last sort of 4 or 5 weeks, have been playing really good stuff.
Middlesbrough were very, placid in that first half. They their performance against Spurs was a bit like Spurs' performance against Liverpool. They just sat back, let them come at them, gave them all the possession. I think the possession stats for the first half were almost identical to those of Liverpool-Tottenham. And Tottenham should have been out of sight by half-time. But Middlesbrough upped their game considerably in the second half and pulled a goal back with, I think, 5 minutes to go. And Spurs were rattled and they could have snatched a late equaliser.
Well, Spurs still look really shaky at the back, yeah. Right? I mean, they haven't got a clean sheet in nine, I think, now. They play Watford on Saturday, and you sort of think, quite fancy Watford for that. You know, the way Watford are playing at home, particularly. And Mourinho has not sorted out Tottenham's defence.
Mourinho, who's obviously never shy of blowing his own trumpet, but he did make the point that if he wanted to strengthen that defence and make them more difficult to break down, he could do so, but in his view, at the expense of taking something away from the attacking portion of the team. And he is saying that that is the calculation he's made, and he's happy, up to a point, I'm sure, to play it this way. I suspect...
Right. They've scored 7 goals in the last 7 games, so that's not really working either. So, I don't know. I can see why he would say that, and I can see that there can be some truth in it. I'd still... When he was appointed, my expectation was, well, he'll sort out that defence at least. And that hasn't happened. So.
We were quite cynical on Monday about Jose picking a team against Liverpool basically to say to Daniel Levy, I don't have enough money. But actually, Jafet Tanganga played well in that game, played well in this game as well, John. Is it possible that actually he's a good player and a good young player that Mourinho has picked because he's good, not because he's saying I don't have any players?
Yeah, I think I'd take that one at face value. I think it's possible to exaggerate the impact that he's had. He made mistakes in the games, which is to be expected. He almost cost Spurs a couple of goals, I think, in the Middlesbrough game, in fact, although he did a lot of good things as well. I think that he's been picked on merit, and what I found interesting about him was I wasn't really aware he was particularly on the Tottenham radar, and then he's come through and done an impressive job. One of the things that strikes me about the defensive side of things for Spurs is that they have a couple of players who really are either out of contract soon or don't anymore want to be there, who might otherwise give them a bit more solidity in defence, and unfortunately an Eric Dier who, because of the appendix problem he's had and then the problems that he's had subsequent to that with his immune system and so on, is no longer anywhere near, sadly, the player that I think he was at one point. And I think those things have hit them badly. Obviously, I suspect they're missing Trippier more than they thought they would as well. And it's added up to a bit of a defensive weakness for them.
The end of Christian Eriksen, we think. I mean, he sort of handed his shirt to a fan after the Liverpool game. He did the same in this game. You know, Inter are offering to pay 10 million euros. Levy wants double that. So he may just keep handing his shirt through the whole of the window and then not hand it out at the end.
Well, he seemed to, you know, following the Liverpool game, it was almost as if he was saying a big goodbye to the Tottenham fans and they didn't really care. I was like, yeah, whatever. If he does, I've been a huge fan of his since he was 17 years old, playing for Denmark in the Euros. And I can't remember when it was, but I think we may have seen the best of him.
The best of him as a footballer, or the best of him here just because the Spurs thing has ebbed him?
I think we may have seen the best of him as a footballer, but he could well prove me wrong. I think he needs to leave Spurs, and he clearly wants to, and just get a fresh start. I don't think he owes Spurs a whole lot. It makes me a little bit sad that he didn't do himself justice in the Champions League final last season. He had a poor game, and that I was hoping he would, you know, put on a show, and he didn't really get that opportunity. Just one thing about the Spurs, a lot of Republic of Ireland fans are very cross with Jose for not giving Troy Parrott any part in this game, because we all obviously want him to get minutes so he can be Ireland's saviour in the forthcoming playoffs for the Euros. But Jose, despite complaining that he doesn't have a centre forward, he does have a 17-year-old, very promising 17-year-old centre forward there, who he hasn't given even a place on the bench to. Now, I pointed this out on Twitter. People said, "Yeah, well, maybe he's not as good as everyone says. Maybe he's not ready, and maybe he isn't." But it seemed like the ideal opportunity to at least stick him on the bench and give him.
Well, the other thing with him, he's a big lad, isn't he? Yeah. 6'3", something like that.
Big lump.
So, given the way Mourinho wants to play, you know, given he increasingly likes to play direct, you know, he seems, the way that Mourinho seems to now struggle with how other teams press him seems to have led to him bypassing midfield more than he did, say, in his first spell at Chelsea. So if he wants to go long, a 6'3" lad surely is quite a good
I mean, I love the rumours that they're after Llorente again and Benteke. Stick them in a 4-4-2. What a dream that would be. Eriksen was been a Spurs 6.5 seasons. The feeling in Denmark when he joined it was a kind of stepping stone to something bigger. Has he missed that opportunity, or is Inter bigger, John? What do you think?
I'm not sure Inter is particularly bigger at the moment. I think he hoped that he would end up somewhere that wasn't Inter, but if that's what there is out there for him at the moment, then I can understand why he's keen to grab it. I can also understand why he might be keen to publicise their interest in that, perhaps the hope of smoking out something else if there is something else there for him. My sense was that he perhaps envisaged himself being more in a Real Madrid kind of shirt, but clearly Inter having a very good season, domestically at least, and it's possible for sure that he could go there and win some titles. I do find their apparent accumulation of Premier League players intriguing, with Giroud now it seems the latest one who's heading there. Ashley Young, there's been interest as well. Lukaku's obviously gone, and Sanchez has gone, and so on. So interesting.
It's like the new MLS, isn't it, Inter? Jadson Fernandes has signed on an 18-month loan from Benfica for Spurs, with an option to buy at the end of it for a lot of money. A 21-year-old Portuguese central midfielder, often plays more advanced. West Ham were interested, thought they had him. Chelsea and Everton and Manchester United apparently rumoured. Do we know any more about him, Wilson?
Well, not a huge amount, but he was obviously highly promising. But he hasn't actually played that much for Benfica, so I don't think people should expect an instant impact.
All right. Harry Kane's injury is apparently worse than first thought. Mourinho said, we expect him to be out until mid-April, end of April, May, next season. I don't know.
That's what I'd say if I wanted the club to buy me a new centre forward. And I'd also, you know, not be able to see Troy Parrott.
I'll tell you what's going to happen here. Kane will be out till the end of the season. He'll be semi-fit a couple of weeks before the Euros. There'll be a big national debate. Should he play? Should he not? They'll end up playing him. He won't be fit enough, and it'll cost England their tilt at yet another title. Oh. You could set your watch by it now.
But it is nice to have certainties in a world of flux.
What a positive way to finish part one. We'll start part two with Newcastle's win over Rochdale. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Next Monday, Barry, we're going to be in Brighton.
Hurrah!
The Salisbury Theatre.
Not the weather for Brighton, really, but... you know.
We'll still go for a swim.
Can we get fish and chips?
Of course we can get fish and chips. I'm not your dad, Barry. we're sold out, by the way, but come and see us on the cobbled beach with our fish and chips. Me, Barry, Ellis James, Nicky Bandini. We're sold out in Dublin now, 27th, 28th. I look forward to seeing you then. And then March the 9th and 10th. We've sold out Edinburgh on the 10th at the Pleasance. The 9th, still have a few tickets left at the Glasgow University Debating Chambers. Me, Barry, Lars, plus one. Come along, please. Newcastle 4, Rochdale 1. Joel Linton scored his first goal since August, ending a run of 20 games without a goal. He went over and hugged Steve Bruce. Tony Cowards, the comedian, said, why is no one pronouncing Joel Linton the accurate and much more fun way? Joel Linton, to rhyme with Wellington. Is that where we should go, Wilson? You've been doing that.
Well, since Tim Stillman was here and explained, I've been trying a sort of hybrid Joel Linton.
Joel Linton is what Tim told us to say.
Well, there is a lot more funny noises than that.
Almiron's got 3-3 now. Two were against Rochdale, to be fair, but still, that's a nice little run for him. A classic own goal, sort of poacher's striker's finish for the first from the Rochdale centre-back. Jordan Williams getting the consolation at 4-0 down, looking very happy about it. He's 24, his first goal in senior football. Graham says, is the Newcastle injury crisis so bad that they might need to call up a character from one of Steve Bruce's novels? That would be the dream, wouldn't it?
Well, I think that the injury crisis is somewhat not as critical as it was, because Matt Ritchie started that game, Andy Carroll played a bit, and Jonjo Shelvey came back, and I think...
if you're having an injury crisis, it's a bit of a cheat to say Andy Carroll's part of it.
And Alan Saint-Maximé is, I think...
What about Alan Saint-Maximin? Both of them are back.
Both of them are back training and should be fit within a week or two. So I actually thought Rochdale might win this game. I fancied them because Newcastle were so in such disarray injury-wise, and Newcastle aren't renowned for the seriousness with which they take the FA Cup, although I think Steve Bruce does want to go as far into it as he can. But, yeah, they swatted Rochdale aside pretty easily.
Do you think Newcastle should have a good old go at the FA Cup, John, or do you think they should take the harsh realities of a lower mid-table Premier League side?
No, they've got to have a go at it, of course. Of course they do. It's a rare chance for them to actually achieve something. I had some sympathy for Bruce, though, that happened to be the game against Rochdale where Mike Ashley pitched up for the first time this season, just before he and Ashley were due to have talks over potential transfers. And of course, they go and score 4 goals, and perhaps Ashley walks away thinking everything's not quite as desperate as it really is, and gets a chance not to spend as much as Bruce might like him to. It would be interesting to see what those talks brought, because they are in need of reinforcements. There's no question about that.
Home to Oxford in the next round. I watched the highlights on the FA's, the YouTube channel from the FA, and they have the same commentator on all the games, but pretending to be at the game. So this commentator was simultaneously at Newcastle, at Coventry or Birmingham watching the Coventry game, at Blackpool and at Shrewsbury, and presumably also went to Tranmere for that game that was postponed, but sounding like he's really there. Other games that happened, Carlisle 3, Cardiff 4. This was fun, wasn't it? Just like in their 2-2 draw the other weekend, Cardiff had to come from behind, 1-0 down to 3-1 up, stayed ahead for the rest of the game. Even though Carlisle's Harry McCurdy, not Scottish, scored twice early in the second half. Shrewsbury 1, Bristol City 0. Absolutely brilliant goal from Aaron Pierre, wasn't it? Talk us through it, Barry.
Well, he just, I think 1 minute left on the clock and picked up the ball, drove forward a little and just leathered it. It was a very low screamer, but it was still a screamer.
It was a low screamer that was going so fast that it bounced at the bottom of, at the back of the net and went up into the top corner, which gave it a nice feel.
Absolute beauty.
And they were very happy because that means they play Liverpool in the next round. Coventry beat Bristol Rovers, 2 assists from Callum O'Hare, who's at Coventry on loan from Villa. The second goal scored by Josh Pask on his debut. He's on loan from West Ham. Terrible run of form for Bristol Rovers since Graham Coughlan left to manage Mansfield Town. Winless in 8, dropped out of the playoffs. Coughlan's new side of just 1 win in 6, so bad for all of them.
It's an interesting one about this. Coventry now have to play Birmingham City, whose ground they play in, but they will be the home side and Birmingham City will be the away side at Birmingham City's ground.
I guess quite fun for the Birmingham fans to be in the away end, to go and see what it's like for opposition fans.
Getting charged £55 rather than £35 or whatever.
From the Coventry website, Coventry City and Birmingham City have worked closely together this season in making the ground share arrangement as successful as it could be this season, developing a friendly and productive relationship between the clubs, and we will again work closely for this game, aiming to ensure a great experience for all supporters. Each club will have about half the tickets, it's an all-ticket game. Reading won 2-0 at Blackpool. From the highlights, commentated by the same man, I noticed.
Did you not even do different accents?
No,
but because, I mean, if you did it, you would at least attempt different accents, right?
I'd do a Jim White.
Jim White would be at one.
Yeah, that's about it. Yeah. Lucas Boyer, 23.
So when he was doing the commentaries for each game, did he sound excited?
Yeah. And also, he knew exactly. He was so you know, when some sort of random Rochdale centre-back scored an own goal, he knew exactly straight away. It's almost like he'd seen the highlights already. But he did a reasonably good job. I mean, you know, for an aspiring commentator. Or a man on the way down. Who knows? Quite an easy gig.
But you're saying definitely not at the top right now.
This is far from someone who's not at the top of his game to another man not at the top of his
game.
Did
you feel you're on the way up or down?
I think I peaked about 8 years ago. But I could have another, you know, I could have an Indian summer.
Your sort of John Travolta late career surge when
possibly
the Tarantino of podcasts is.
No, you see, now Oatley's got Sunday Supplement. I thought that could have been a good move for me.
You never thought that was your gig, though, surely?
I don't know.
Just to point out, you do have a radio show.
At the same time
as Sunday
looking
Supplement.
To get away from that for quite some time.
Do the listeners know that, in fact, there's only one person with you in this room at the moment pretending to be Jonathan Wilson, Barry Glendenning?
That's why we have such ridiculous stereotypical accents.
Anyway, I noticed from this game that there's an Argentinian called Lucas Boyer who looked really quite good from the 3-minute highlights. He plays for Reading. Tranmere have to wait for their replay with Watford after that 3-3 draw. Prenton Park was waterlogged. A problem which also saw last weekend's meeting between Liverpool and Manchester United in the WSL postponed. So that means On Saturday, Watford could start a run of 4 games in 9 days. They've got Spurs Saturday in the league. On Tuesday, they play Aston Villa midweek. 2 days later on Thursday is the rescheduled game at Tranmere. And if they win that, they host Manchester United on the Sunday in the FA Cup.
Well, Watford really have nobody but themselves to blame for being in that predicament, because they were 3-0 up against Tranmere in the first game and shipped 3 goals. So my sympathy levels for them would be somewhere around the zero mark.
On the subject of Watford, they play Spurs in the early kick-off on Saturday. And we discussed the Nigel Pearson anecdote about him eating a wolf, basically, didn't he? And Alexandru Mercier, and I hope I've pronounced that correctly, got in touch with some real detail on this. He says, wow, the Nigel Pearson anecdote sure did change a lot since the first utterance. As someone with family into sheep farming in the Carpathians, please allow me to set the record straight. For me, the Pearson story was always about being pushed away from the sheep flock by its guardian dogs until he did not represent a threat anymore. It happened to me as well once, the greatest scare of my life. He then pointed me in the direction of a YouTube video of the dogs, the sheepdogs that work in the Carpathian Mountains. And they're like polar bears.
Oh, are these the ones that think they're sheep?
No. I think they think they're bears looking at them.
Because I was in Patagonia before Christmas,
mm-hmm.
and stayed on this estancia, and they had 14,000 sheep, but they lose 25 a day to puma attacks.
Oh, really?
They're not allowed to kill pumas. Pumas are protected. And so what they now do, they have these huge white shaggy dogs. I think they're Pyrenean in origin. And these dogs sort of, you know, they look sort of from a distance like sheep. And apparently the dogs think they're sheep, and they interact with the sheep. But obviously they're much harder than sheep. So the pumas sort of, you know, they can smell it's a dog, not a sheep. And they stay clear. And it was in no sense an aggressive thing, but I went on horseback to visit a shepherd in the next valley. I also got escorted off a property by one of these, like a literal sheepdog.
That's a great story. Do pumas wear puma kings?
Yeah, I think they must do, yeah. They're
you wouldn't see them in a Copa Mundial.
No, that's not their thing at all.
No. Game of the weekend, Liverpool-Manchester United, 4:30 on Sunday. Patrick says,
couldn't disagree more.
Oh, okay.
Game of the weekend is Norwich-Bournemouth. Oh,
huge game at the bottom, isn't it?
Well, it is a huge game. I mean, I like you, assumed Liverpool-Manchester United was the game of the weekend. And then I was thinking, well, it isn't really. It's arguably one of the most meh, because, you know, Liverpool are going to win the league and Manchester United aren't going to do anything. It's very much a nothing game, the high-profile nature of it.
Well, United are the only team to have taken points off Liverpool this season. There is that.
But even if
Solskjaer got Klopp's number?
I imagine if you looked in his mobile, he probably does.
Yeah, okay, in that sense, possibly, that is true, yeah. And especially if Rashford is injured. You can imagine Rashford causing problems. Hang on, which game are we talking about now?
We can do Liverpool-Manchester United. Right. We do them both together.
You can imagine Rashford getting in behind Alexander-Arnold, but if Rashford's not there,
It's harder for him to do it.
Yeah. It's very hard to see that as anything other than a comfortable Liverpool win.
True. Although, if you seem to suggest, Barry, it wouldn't mean a lot if Manchester United managed to get something out of this game. But I wonder, John, actually, if you do manage to stay unbeaten against Liverpool, well, as Patrick says, can United snatch this season's ultimate accolade and go unbeaten against Liverpool for the season? It's not a bad thing to achieve.
That'd be fantastic for them. Do I see it happening? No, I agree with Jonathan there. I absolutely can't see it happening.
So just on that, when Wolves got promoted to the Premier League, mm-hmm. and had a fantastic season, mm-hmm. I think Sunderland were the only team to avoid defeat against them. We still got relegated. Doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
Come on.
Well, I think if you were a Manchester United supporter, you would take some comfort from the fact that they would have come through 2 games against the champions and lost neither of them. But as I say, I don't see that happening. I think this is a Liverpool win, and as Jonathan says, especially without Rashford. And it didn't look good for him at all when he went off the other night.
Here's a question from Sean. If Roy Hodgson and his Liverpool team replaced the current one right now, would Liverpool still win the league? So Roy Hodgson's Liverpool faced United once in his time there. The team was Pepe Reina, Glenn Johnson, Carragher, Skirtle, Konchesky, Maxi Rodriguez, Steven Gerrard, Christian Poulsen, Raul Morelos, Joe Cole and Fernando Torres. If we got that squad at that, not, you know, at their
peak,
at that time, Would they still win the league? I think Liverpool need to win 12 games to guarantee that they win the league.
I'm not sure I'd ever back Steven Gerrard to win anything, like other than kind of dramatic 3-3 draws.
All right.
You sort of fear the Gerrard factor would drag them down, that his sort of the misfortune and
Didn't he win a single-handedly win an FA Cup final?
He single-handedly drew it 3-3, for sure.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought they'd won that.
Well, they won it on penalties.
Ah, I forgot.
I mean, he scored that quite a good goal.
You know, when I talked about the 3-3s, that was the reference.
Do apologise.
No, it's fine. But that would be fun, because I'd like to see Liverpool fans having to worship at the feet of Roy Hodgson and hail the first manager to win the league for them in 30 years. That would be hilarious.
Roy's Palace go to the Etihad. Anger says, with Benteke, Wickham, Ayew, some credit there, and Tosin now on Palace's books, who should be our next underperforming, underwhelming and overpaid striker signing be?
You see, Cenk Tosin, I saw quite a bit of him when he was at Besiktas, and I really liked the look of him. I was really disappointed by how it turned out at Everton. And I don't know if that's him, I don't know if it's Everton, but he seemed to have everything to succeed. I mean, I don't quite get why it hasn't worked.
He's a very pure striker of a ball. He just doesn't seem to be in the position to kick it.
But he's
very
also
often.
He takes the ball down well. He's got good chest control. He's reasonable in the air. I thought it was a really good signing for Everton. I hope it works here, because otherwise I might have been wrong.
Mm.
And I don't like that.
Arsenal play Sheffield United, Brighton, Villa, Norwich, Bournemouth. Okay, let's talk about how massive that game is then, Baz.
It is a big game. I considering they're at home. And considering how dreadful Bournemouth have been in recent games, I fancy Norwich to win this and plunge Bournemouth into even more trouble than they're in already. And they're in, I think, a lot of trouble.
Yeah. I think Bournemouth have been... I think it's one of those seasons where... It's a very similar thing when Steve Bruce's last full season at Sunderland, where a combination of injuries and the wrong fixtures at the wrong times have absolutely done them. So they've got a horrendous injury crisis at the minute, and they've also got to start winning games, because I think from the end of March they've got a horrific run of fixtures. I think they play all of the big six plus Wolves plus Leicester in the space of 9 games or something. They've really got to win games now, but now is when they haven't got the players to win the games.
If I remember correctly, the last time they'd been on a poor run, which was recently, and it was said they really have to get a win now, they went and beat Chelsea. Now, since then, they've done very poorly again, so it stands out as a slightly odd result in among a lot of poor results. But it may well be that they can repeat that feat against Norwich in the knowledge that really they've got to do something this weekend.
I mean, the problem is, if they don't win this, just psychologically, if you're in that situation and you can't beat Norwich, then you start to think it's over, right?
Yeah, they look like they can't buy a win for love nor money. But you hope they stick. Do we hope they stick with Eddie Howe? I mean, I sort of do.
I think they will stick with Eddie Howe. My sense is that they would even be relegated with Eddie Howe, assuming that he didn't feel that it was necessary for him to leave before that point. Whether he would then stick around, I don't know. But I don't think there's any appetite within the club to get rid of him.
I mean, there's presumably a concern. If it were to go down, presumably there's huge financial concerns. Because, I mean, the stadium's got 10,500 capacity. So my guess is they're pretty reliant on Premier League TV money. So there's then suddenly pressure that they have to go up while the parachute payments are there.
Be interesting to know as well what's built into contracts there in the way of relegation. I suspect they've been sensible enough to factor that in.
Most clubs are, and you assume the way they run themselves they would have been. But yeah, absolutely, I could really screw them.
And we're about to enter, aren't we, a new cycle of increased TV revenue. So going down this season, I think, would be particularly... well, inverted commas, catastrophic. To me, Eddie Howe seems to be a man who's has the look about him of someone who thinks, I think maybe I need to not be here anymore.
Or does he think I should have gone a couple of years ago?
I suspect that's probably the case too. His stock was very high. You know, he was being talked about as a potential next Arsenal manager, you know. And I can remember some years ago when Owen Coyle was in a similar position. It doesn't take that long for your stock to fall.
If our pod, you know, perish the thought, went to number 2 in the charts, do you take a financial hit? Is that in your contract, Barry?
No. I get paid as inadequately as before.
Southampton play Wolves. Newcastle, Chelsea's the late game on Saturday. Burnley, Leicester, the other game on Sunday. West Ham play Everton at 3 on Saturday. And Matt Hughes writing in the Mail that the Premier League are set to scrutinise Alisher Usmanov's naming rights deal for Everton's proposed stadium amid concerns from rival clubs it could constitute a breach of the organisation's rules. The announcement that Usmanov's holding company, USM, has spent $30 million on the option to buy the naming rights for a ground that is due to open in 2023 and for which building work is yet to begin was greeted with incredulity by Everton's top-flight rivals. Premier League rules E.54, one of my favourites, of the Premier League rules, states that any commercial deal arising from a related party transaction must be recorded in the club's annual accounts at a fair market value. This coming in the same week that they announced a record loss of $111.8 million for the financial year to June 2019, a huge drop from last year's $13.1 million loss and the previous year's $30 million profit. From Paul Wilson's report, he says, Premier League sustainability rules allow for £105 million loss in any three-year period. Everton are currently nearing that maximum with overspending of around £94 million, though the club say they are committed to operating in a financially sustainable manner. And that'll do for part two. Part three will begin with Sid in Spain and Barcelona's new manager. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. So, Ernesto Valverde out, Quique Setién in at the Nou Camp. Let's talk to Sid Lowe about it all. Sid, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm marvellous. Thanks very much. From the outside, you know, Valverde winning two La Ligas in a row and being top of the league, most wins, most goals this season through to the Champions League last 16, seems like quite a harsh decision.
Yeah, I think from the inside, there are a lot of people who think this hasn't been well-timed. And a lot of people who think it hasn't been well handled. But I don't think there are that many people who would say it was necessarily the wrong decision to change managers. In fact, I think a lot of people in Spain would have said, look, this is something that probably should have happened in the summer. But having not happened in the summer should probably have waited till the end of the season. Now, on the face of it, you're absolutely right. Two league titles. And Gerard Piqué, for example, his kind of goodbye message. And, you know, thank you very much. You leave at the top of the table and you left us with two league titles. But, of course, Rome and Liverpool, those two Champions League games, did him a lot of damage. And there was always this debate about the style and how well they were playing. And definitely there's no doubt that this season has been a really quite significant regression in their form. You look at their away form in particular, I think it's only 4 wins in 10 games in La Liga.
And in terms of how it was handled, you know, Setién is not Barcelona's first choice. They went for Xabi and Koeman as well, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They went to Xavi in Doha. Xavi wasn't expecting it, but they offered him the job there and then. I mean, he knew that, of course, they would sound him out about taking this job at some point in the future. He's also friends with Abidal anyway, so it wasn't particularly surprising that the meeting happened, but the content of that meeting was. They then went to Koeman, who was also surprised by this because there'd been discussions with Koeman before about taking over Barcelona after the European Championships. He's always made it very clear that he wants to see the European Championships through, try and win it with the Netherlands, and then he would become available. And in fact, he's even said this publicly in interviews 2 or 3 times. But then suddenly they're saying, well, how about now? He says no. And it was interesting in Setién's press conference, in his presentation press conference, because José Mario Bartomeu, the president of Barcelona, was trying to say that this was kind of a process that had been going on a while. Now, I don't doubt that it is a process that's been going on a while in terms of some of the doubts, in terms of some of the thinking about who the candidates may be. But that this was a process that's been going on a while is simply not true. And Setién damaged that line because almost immediately after, he said, well, they phoned me up yesterday and it didn't take me more than 5 minutes to decide.
Yeah, he was walking through a field of sheep, wasn't he, or something?
Cows, yeah. Cows, he was in his hometown walking through a field of cows.
Tell us about him. As soon as he got the job, a lot of football hipsters on social media went slightly wobbly at the knees.
Well, as well they might, on one level at least. I mean, there's lots of doubts, and obviously, you know, on the face of it, a guy that's only been at Las Palmas and Betis in the first division has also been at Poliegido and a few smaller Poliegido, Lugo, Racing Santander. It is a bit odd, but if those people and weak at the knees had been reading me over the last couple of years at least, this is someone that I've always been quite excited about because he's very much a disciple of Cruyff. He wants his teams to play. They've been great to watch, Betis and Las Palmas. They overachieved, albeit they overachieved to start with, and then there was a very significant downward turn, if you like, towards the end of his careers at both clubs. He left both clubs, in Las Palmas' case, with certain difficulties with the board. At Betis's case, some difficulties with the fans. But he's very exciting and he does fit the Barcelona identity. But he said it himself, and I think he probably gave the best analysis of this in his presentation. He said, look, I haven't got a long CV. I haven't got loads of trophies. All I've got is a belief in philosophy. And I don't know if that was enough for them to have rung me. And of course, in different circumstances and at different times, he's probably right. It probably wouldn't have been enough.
There's something romantic about it, and there's something romantic about how much he loves Lionel Messi and the fact that, you know, there aren't that many managers that are going to get a chance to work with Messi, right, are there?
Yeah, I mean, look, we've seen loads of presentations over the years, written about loads of presentations over the years, and people tend to say the right things, and they tend to be incredibly enthusiastic, but this was more than that. He actually looked genuinely overwhelmed at times by this, and it's absolutely genuine, his commitment to kind of Cruyffism, his the kind of things he said, not just now, but in the past about Messi and Busquets, and his Real Betis team, who are the last team, by the way, to beat Barcelona at home. His Real Betis team beat Barcelona 4-3 in about a year and a quarter ago, and he left with Sergio Busquets' shirt, which Busquets had signed to him, saying, "Tu quieres Etienne," with affection and admiration for the way that you see football. And that admiration is absolutely mutual. And this is one of the other things that I think is significant about Setien, is that none of this is an act. This isn't him saying the right things to the cameras. He really does believe this. Of course, what that means is it poses questions, doesn't it, about the relationship with players like Messi, because you're almost fawning in your praise of Messi. You've now got to reconstruct a relationship where, in theory at least, you're the boss.
If Setien's only come to prominence now and spent most of his career below the top tier of clubs, what's changed? Has he changed his philosophy? You indicate he hasn't at all. Has football just sort of caught up?
I mean, it's kind of the perfect timing of a series of elements. But one of them is he absolutely hasn't changed. He is exactly the same. Is that it's just sort of the way it happened. And I know that's a pretty poor answer for you, and it doesn't explain it fully. But Quique Setién is a man who started coaching because he kind of was there at Racing Santander, the club where he's been all his life, and he took over because he was part of a group of people who'd taken control of the club, and then he took over as manager and did really, really well. He then carried on coaching, in his words, because he had to, because it was a job, because he needed the money, he needed to work. But he wasn't really, his heart sort of wasn't necessarily in it. But then, of course, he found that it was when he started doing it. And then he gets a job at Lugo. But he's also been someone who directors, I think, have seen as slightly difficult because he's so principled, because he's so committed to his ideas. Of course, that occasionally creates a certain tension. And then he goes to Las Palmas. What he does at Las Palmas is extraordinary, although it then tails off. He goes to Betis. What he does there to start with is extraordinary, although it tails off. But that point at Betis, because that's the first division, people start to take notice. You know, the ideas were the same in the second division, being in the second division. But then people start to take notice. And I say the fact that it's come up now, well, there's a series of kind of momentary reasons for it. He's the only manager, for example, I think in the last 10 years to have beaten Real Madrid and Barcelona away from home. He wins the Seville Derby 5-3 with goals flying in all over the place. He beats Barcelona 4-3 at the Camp Nou. People start to talk about him. He then also speaks very well. It's not just that his teams play like this. He talks like a kind of, if you like, a defender of the faith. He talks like someone who's completely committed to this. And then that means, of course, that then it becomes a media interest, partly because it's not just what you see on the pitch, it's the words that back it up. And I think those things have just kind of come together at the right time. And the fact that it's taken so long is really just because for a long time he couldn't be bothered and wasn't really in it. For a long time he was kind of coaching at clubs just because, well, why not? And it wasn't really, I mean, he didn't get into the first division at all in 1957. And of course, if you're not coaching the first division, it's very unlikely anyone's going to take any notice of you at all.
So Barca home to Granada this weekend. Biggest game elsewhere looks like Real Madrid against Sevilla. Real won 1-0 in the reverse fixture in September. They're unbeaten in 10. So Setien has some competition at the top, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, this is the other thing, of course, the context of the two league titles they've won. They finished, I think it's 16 and 19 points ahead of Real Madrid in the two seasons under Valverde. And that should be enough to say, wow, what an achievement. But, of course, it was partly because Madrid weren't very good. This year, Madrid do look a little bit stronger. Obviously, Barcelona have tailed off in terms of points enormously from last year. But it does feel like there's competition. And it's curious, because I think we're all looking at Madrid thinking they look strong. They probably look like favourites now. But it's partly because of the competitiveness and the seriousness and the sort of solidity of them, more than because they're actually playing sparkling football. And certainly they do, I still think, have a problem with scoring goals.
Righty-ho then, Sid. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Cheerio.
Sid Lowe, out in Spain, elsewhere. Enya Luko's retired at the age of 32. She was most recently at Juventus, leaving in December after winning Serie A and the Coppa Italia. With Chelsea, she won the WSL three times and the FA Women's Cup twice. Before her international career came to an abrupt and premature end, she'd played 102 times for England, scoring 33 times. She'd not been included in an England squad since accusing the former manager of the national team, Mark Sampson, of discrimination in 2016. She said to The Guardian, "I very much feel like I'm ending on a high with a sense that there's not much more I can do in the game. I think when you know, you know, you get the feeling that it's enough." AFCON confirmed the 2021 African Cup of Nations will take place in January and February next year in Cameroon after the last one was in the summer. I was under the impression that they were always going to be in the summer now.
Yes, Jonathan. I think we all were. Mm-hmm. And it was decided yesterday to change it. Ahmed Ahmed, the president of CAF, he said that Cameroon requested this on the grounds of climate. Now, there is a certain logic to that, that if you look at the average rainfall in Yaoundé, I know Cameroon is a big country, very diverse weather, but Yaoundé is, I think, where the final would be. They have an average of 155 millimetres of rain in June, and the average temperature is 28 degrees. So that is very hot and very humid. And I think the humidity particularly is the issue. But where I think this is, I mean, and clearly the real reason this has moved is because of the new expanded Club World Cup in the summer of 2021 in China, that FIFA cannot have a couple of nations clashing with that. Well, this is storing up a load of problems down the line, because in 2023, the Cup of Nations is going to be in Cote d'Ivoire. Now, if you look at the weather in Abidjan in June, I think it's 375 millimetres of rain and an average temperature of 29 degrees. So there's even more reason to move our tournament away from June to January. But of course, January 2023 is going to be 3 weeks after the World Cup final. So, I mean, and also, this probably won't happen in Cameroon anyway because of the problems they've had building stadiums and because of the internal tensions in Cameroon. So I'm fully prepared to go to Morocco in January 2021 rather than...
So you don't think it'll be in Cameroon?
No, I think it'll be in Morocco.
Right.
But that's me kind of making an educated guess.
Why isn't AFCON for every 4 years?
I think what FIFA would like is for it to be on a four-year cycle and for it to be the same year as the Euros and the Copa America, and to run concurrently with the Euros and the Copa America. Now, that would be a big problem, I think, in terms of the sort of global audience it would then attract. But the reason it doesn't is essentially that the Cup of Nations began in 1957, and the reason it was set up was because African football wasn't getting a look in. You know, there was only they had a playoff for one World Cup spot. So African nations boycotted the 1966 World Cup because they only got this half place. So they set up their own tournament, you know, before the Euros. And certainly Sahatu, who, you know, the former president of CAF, with whom there were many reasons to find fault. But I think on this, he was always very sort of forthright and made a lot of sense, saying, you know, why should CAF bend to FIFA's whim? FIFA's done nothing for us. We want to protect the integrity of our own tournament. And so, you know, they won it every 2 years. And to an extent, I think that's become increasingly important and necessary as the best African players no longer play in Africa. So a chance to get them back in domestic stadiums in Africa, is, you know, and do it every 2 years, I think is a nice thing. I mean, the way it tends to work out, they set ticket prices too high, they set ridiculous security protocols, and nobody actually goes to the games anyway. But That's the logic, is CAF saying, no, this is our tournament, stop messing about with
it. How political is where they host it? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, massive. Africa is so massive that, you know, if you have it in Egypt, it's not easy for the Namibian fans to get there, right?
Yeah, and there's all kinds of issues with that. There's a very clear North African, sub-Saharan African divide. There's massive issues with Algerian fans getting to the final in Cairo this year. That's a perennial problem. And then, you know, it I can't remember the last time. I think 2012 was the last time it was hosted where it was meant to be hosted. It keeps on being moved for political reasons and conflict and Ebola and all kinds of things.
Closer to home, Keith says, is there a better title race anywhere in Europe? And he is talking about the Northern Ireland Premiership. And I, on Monday night, happened to watch Cliftonville v Linfield, and it was so wet the 4G pitch looked like it cut up. I mean, it was just unbelievable. But the top of the table, Linfield played 23, 50 points. Glentoran played 24, 50 points. Cliftonville played 24, 50 points. Crusaders played 25, 49. And Coleraine played 25, 47. So that's a very exciting league.
Yeah, but if you say that in a Northern Ireland accent, it will sound really dull.
What have you got against the Northern Irish, Barry?
Nothing. It's just the accent. They never.
I don't know. Colin Murray sounds quite enthusiastic all the time.
Yeah. If you hear anything in a Northern Ireland accent, it sort of just brings you down.
Okay. good news for Japanese striker Kazuyoshi Miura has just signed on the dotted line to play in the J1 League, Japan's top division, for the 2020 season. He's 52. He turns 53 in February. His professional career started in 1986.
That's 10 years before Silent Witness began.
He featured in the original FIFA 96 game. He did only play 3 times last season without a goal. He retired from international football 20 years ago after winning 89 caps from Japan. I hope he said, I want to prolong my club career.
I'm a bit unsure about this. I sort of think this is a bit of a self-fulfilling myth.
Or like a PR stunt?
Yeah, I mean, maybe not quite as blatant as that. But, I mean, he hasn't played regularly for quite a while. And when he has played, he's looked pretty ropey. So I know he's a massive hero in Japan. But I'm not convinced by it.
Number one on the day he was born, please release me, Engelbert Humperdinck. Now, we were talking about stats on...
Which is probably what he's saying to his club.
On the subject of... we were talking about stats and if they're added after a VAR decision. You know, Soyuncu got booked at the weekend, but it was overturned because VAR had happened. And we were wondering if your Opta stats, Pitt says, are removed after the point of a foul if VAR takes play back for an earlier offence. Now we know. Barry, you pointed out some good news for Mr. Portsmouth, didn't you, today?
Oh, yeah. Mr. Portsmouth, the guy with the bell, as he's not quite known by opposition fans. You know, most people will know him as the guy with the top hat and the tattoos and wears the waistcoat to games and rings the ship's bell. His name is John Westwood, and I was quite surprised some years ago to discover that he's family, and he runs an antiquarian bookshop selling old books, maps, charts, things like that. But the other day, I noticed one of the main stories, or the most read stories in The Guardian today, was that his bookshop in Petersfield Bookshop in Hampshire, whoever was running it that day tweeted a forlorn tweet saying that they hadn't had any customers, they hadn't sold a single thing all day. And the tweet got traction. I think it was retweeted by some famous author. And within hours, they had a deluge of orders for books. Over £1,000 worth of books were ordered. But I saw the story in the Guardian, and there's no mention of John being Mr. Portsmouth.
No. Well, I saw the picture, and
I recognised him. But I'd never seen him without all his Portsmouth gear on. He looks quite, you know... He's got a white shirt and a waistcoat and a tie and glasses on chain here. Very unlike his public persona.
Good news or bad news for Oxford City, who tweeted, the club was not aware Finn Tapp, who is one of their defenders, was going on Love Island. This is normal protocol for all contestants. We understand and wish Finn good luck on the show. He's due to play Braintree on Saturday. He's looking for love at the Love Island villa, which is in South Africa.
I would sack him.
You'd sack him, would you?
Well, I mean, even my university team, if somebody just didn't turn up for, you know, 5 days before a game, so I can't play, I don't care what your excuse is, unless somebody's died, you're out.
Right, so we finish with this from our football editor, Marcus Christensen, who sent us an article from The Guardian. It says, how do you and the others feel about this? And it is a study that says... the age of 47.2 has been discovered to be when people experience peak misery, according to a study. John, how old are you?
45, so a little way to go until I hit peak misery.
Okay, you've got 2 years.
Yeah, not that long.
Do you feel you're heading that way? Or?
Definitely feel I'm heading that way, especially working alongside Marcus on a daily basis. Right. But he's going to get there before I do, so I'll see how bad it is and how I want to react to it, really.
Barry, what?
I've worked this out. Marcus has really been obsessing about this. I will hit peak misery on the 21st of May. It's when I'm 47.2.
This year?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's a Thursday, so okay. We'll be recording a podcast. So
put it in your
people
diaries.
Will be able to judge for themselves if I sound particularly morose.
Oh, marvellous. And that's where we'll end it today. Wilson, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for having me.
Do come again. Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.